Hello, and welcome to the Roving Social Worker Podcast. I am Jay, your roving social worker. Before I lead into the intro for the social work identities pieces, I wanted to reiterate the importance of self-reflection and growth. This is a lifelong process. It doesn't end with the last chapter of a book, with a certification, or even a degree. It is ongoing, sometimes uncomfortable, and we do mess up along the way. I will not speak for my guests, but I will say that I am constantly learning and often unlearning harmful ideas, behaviors, and processes. I hope that listeners can hear that growth as both the podcast and myself age. So before we really begin, I want to add a content warning. Some of the discussions may cause the listener discomfort. It may also cause reflection. Additionally, it does contain sensitive topics and often strong language because, come on, it's the Roving Social Worker Podcast. In the last few episodes, we have been exploring social work identities. Initially, the project's goal was to discuss individual social worker identities. This meant hearing from grad school applicants, current students, social workers in the community, our radical and rabble-rousing social workers, and our social work educators and leaders. After weeks of overwhelming support, I started interviewing these unique individuals, asking them two questions. Who are you and why social work? It is up to the individual social worker to decide on what they would like to share and where they would like to take the conversation. There is no expectation for anyone to place themselves in a compromising position with their family, their community, school, or employer. Remember, this is a public podcast, and when things go to the internet, that is where they outlive us. But that's enough rambling for me. I will let my next guest introduce themselves.
All right, so thank you for having me. My name is William Coombs. I am a doctor of social work, and I run the, practice that is currently building called Talk Taylor. I am the best way to describe myself is a realist who is in this profession because he hates the profession. If that makes sense, my education in social work, you know, as an MSW, you know, before I went back and got my doctorate, was my first job was in crisis intervention, which is actually one of probably the best jobs that you could ever get as a new quote unquote social worker, because there is no demographic that you're set to. You get to see everybody, but everybody that you see in that setting is probably having their worst day. And what I realized on that job is that the education that you get on how to engage and how to talk to people goes out of the window very quick when someone is having suicidal ideation, or you're seeing them because they tried to die. They don't have time for all that. They want to know that someone cares about them, and they want to know what you can do for them in that moment. And what I have always learned to go to, you know, my default is just being myself. And I found a lot of success in that. And it made me ask the question, why are we being taught to do anything other than that? So I wanted to create a program that allowed me to kind of lead with who I am, what I do, and then go from there. And I've always kind of had the person I'm talking to, you don't have to like me. That's not the goal. I'm not trying to make a friend, but you have to understand what I say. You have to hear what I say. And I have to make a difference in your life. I have to be someone who is different from perhaps the multitude of therapists and social workers that you've met before. And it works. You know, go figure. You could, communicating with people as people, being a human, talking to a human, works. And I think that speaks to the fact that we kind of have overcomplicated the art of interaction with other people. And my goal is to bring it back to the most productive way. And it's just being a real person.
Yeah, that authenticity is important. I actually started in crisis too. I hadn't gotten my social work degree. That wasn't a requirement. I just had to have a bachelor's. And then I worked with a person who had a master's degree, usually in behavioral health, counseling, or social work. So I was around a lot of social workers that whole time. And I had done my foundation year in my master's program, but took a break for a lot of reasons. So I think that crisis background is kind of like when you first start a job as a kid working in fast food. Like you learn all these skills. It's not always the most pleasant job. It's usually really fast pace. It's demanding, but you learn a lot in a short period of time. And I think that definitely set me up for kind of where I'm going now. I joked with another person I was interviewing that I always default to crisis. I always find my way back to that type of work because it is so suited for my personality, but it also burns you out really quickly if you're not careful.
No, I definitely agree. Crisis, is not for the weak-hearted. But it is, if you can do that, you can do anything in this profession, right? If you can meet people on their absolute worst day, then everything else comes easily. And, kind of like you said, it fits my personality as well. Like, I prefer to work on the fly. I don't like to be in a situation that is scripted. I prefer to work with kind of feeling the situation out and being authentic, like you say, in the moment. And when you're in the moment with somebody who really needs someone to engage with them on a real level, that's a skill set that I don't think can be taught. It's something that you just either you can do it or you can't do it. And the foundation that you get from operating at that speed on that level every single day, it makes everything else that much easier. But you're right. It's very one of the things that I struggle with, initially is that I would work, my first shift was the evening shift. So I didn't get off until 10 p.m., assuming that the last crisis that I responded to ended then. We get off whenever that last crisis ends. And by the time I get home, my wife and my kids are all in the bed. So it's just me sitting there, with all of this stuff that I did all day and processing it by myself. And, I'd get up and I'd go back and do it again. And for a while I was wondering, like, I would, you go, so say I go through that Monday through Friday, and it's the Friday comes, the weekend comes, and I find myself lashing out at my family and not really understanding why. And, until you take that step back and look, like, I just took on a week's worth of people's worst day and kept that with me, and then went home and then just, say, hey, it's part of the job. And that takes a toll on you. You're taking on other people's trauma, and it comes out. It's gonna come back out, and you really can't predict how that's gonna be. So being able to regulate that is very important for sure.
And part of the regulation and the self-care, it really falls back on the agency. So I was lucky that the first agency I worked for in a crisis setting, so I did mobile teams. So sometimes I was literally in a field providing crisis intervention.
Me too.
It was social work centered, and they purposefully only had us do four tens a week. Now I worked overnight shifts. I was 6 p.m. to 4 a.m. Sometimes I picked the what we joked as the 8 to 8. It was supposed to be 8 to 6, but it always went 8 to 8 because they were the only team for 2 hours in the whole valley. And yeah, it's after a year and a half, I couldn't do night shift anymore. I couldn't do it. I ended up going to an inpatient crisis center that did 3/12s. Well, a 3/12 and then a 4/12. So I think that time off is really really important to kind of self-care, just having an extra day or two to be like, all right, this is how I be a human. And then if you're working like swing shifts and late nights, you have to almost flip back to the real world time. And then suddenly you have to flip back to being a night owl. So it's a demanding job, and there are some people who are just made for it, and then there are people who are MFTs, and they do very well with a Monday through Friday 8 to 5. And I respect them for that because I wouldn't want to sit in an office from 8 to 5 all the time.
Yeah, no, it sounds like, so we did the 4-10s too. You know, I worked for the county, and it was very structured, and it was the same way. And initially I had the, you know, you had the 4 days on, 3 days off. And, you know, you get used to it, you learn to appreciate it. You're now, next thing you know, I'm at home on a Monday and nobody else is there, so I have that time to wind down. What happened with us, unfortunately, is that it would we reshuffled. They reshuffled the deck and everything changed. And it went I went from a, you know, I don't know, my shift was like 11 to 8 or something like that. And then it shifted to 8 to 5, and we lost that extra day off, which didn't realize how important that was until it happened. But the bigger thing that kind of got me was, and you said it's about, you know, how your agency takes care of you, is everything that in terms of care was done in a very cliche way. And that's probably where I started to break away from the traditional social work mold is, you know, when we came back to, you know, clinical supervision or whatever it was to unpack this stuff, we had supervisors, you know, they were awesome at their job, but it would be that typical, guys, how do you feel about this scenario? And okay, well, how did that make you feel? And what was in your mind at the time? I mean, like this very, very structured, scripted thing. And, you know, I look around and I see all the other MFTs and MSWs who weren't confident in who they were as a person or as a professional. So they would eat this stuff up and they give back cliche answers. And I'm over here like, you know, whatever, dude, it was what it was. Like, we work in crisis, we see people don't want to kill themselves, we're going to see stuff. And the same thing, like you say, you were in the field. Like, yeah, on a good day, I'd be in an emergency room. On a busy day, I'd be on an alley somewhere, I'd be on the street, I'd be wherever the crisis happens, that's where we go. And, you know, I'm good enough to do the job, but I felt like there is a better way to do it. And in that county structure, it all seemed very cliche and scripted, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah. Crisis intervention is a combination of things. Obviously, we use a lot of cognitive stuff, but then a lot of behavioral because, like you said, there's no one demographic. I remember getting called to a school for 5-year-olds, and then I've been in nursing homes with individuals that have dementia, and that was just their protocol. Oh, we have to call the crisis team because they want to die, and I'm like, they're 92 with dementia. I would probably have the same feelings. Why don't you have someone talking to them during the day and not at 9 o'clock at night or at shift change? Like, this isn't the first time they've mentioned that. So yeah, crisis will always have a special place in my heart. I'm trying to do kind of a macro way of getting around to it, of developing a crisis response where I'm at right now. I don't know how far it's going to get, but it's once again, I'm always like, oh, we should really have this thing. It's so great. And then I'm like, oh, I'll just go work it because I don't have boundaries. yeah, that's how it works out up here. How would you define yourself in like a sentence? Like, who are you? Say this is an elevator speech. Who are you?
I am a filter between what you think you should get for mental health and what is really important. That would be my definition. And you know, just to not to we'll wrap up the crisis thing, but you know, you're speaking to my heart when you say that thing because I'd be at a school too, and my youngest was 6, and the only reason it got to the point that a crisis team had to intervene with this 6-year-old is because the 6 points of intervention between that did not do their job. They didn't want to intervene and do the job. The teacher said, okay, this kid says something scary, I'm going to send him to the counselor. And the counselor said, okay, this is scary, I'm going to send him to the school resource officer. School resource officer said, protocol is to call the crisis team. Crisis team shows up, and I'm like, hey, dude, what's going on? He's like, I had a bad dream. And I'm like, this is not a crisis, dude. This is somebody needs to ask questions. This is a 6-year-old acting like a 6-year-old. And nobody took the time to ask a question because they were more worried about liability. So that experience, it kind of developed who I am and what I want to be going forward. And so many of these situations, these scenarios, and I've had the dementia patient too, you know, and I'm like, dude, this is dementia. This is what it does. This is not a crisis. This guy should not be here. We should not be trying to send him to a inpatient facility. This is what happens. Somebody needs to care. And no one cared. No one wanted to step in and be that barrier and actually give a damn about the person enough to do the right thing. They want to hand it off to somebody else. So my definition is to be that filter and to cut out all the BS and get straight to, hey, listen, what's going on with you? Let's talk about it. And that's kind of where, you know, Talk Taylor developed. That's where it's going to develop. That is what led me to kind of pursue my own lane.
Something you said spoke to me about kind of perception of you. Like, whomever's coming in to see you, their perception isn't always 100%. So I get the same thing, obviously. You've probably seen pictures of me. If you haven't, I am 5'10", the size of a Viking. I have a faux hawk. My hair is usually some
Purple.
unnatural color. Yeah, that's gone. It was fire engine red for about a year, and now it's kind of orange because I'm trying to go back to white with that purple tint. So, and I have a nose ring. I'm younger. I'm in my early 30s, but apparently I look a little bit younger than that. So when I've had patients come in, kids, teenagers, adolescents, when they come in, they're usually fine. They're like, oh, wait, you're an adult? Yes, I am. Come sit down, let's chat. One time I had a 40-year-old female come in for therapy, a little bit older than that. And she had been seeing another provider there for medications. And he had told her, oh, no, you'll love this therapist. She'll be great for you. So I set up the appointment over the phone. She didn't ever see me, she didn't look me up or anything online. And I go out to get her in the lobby, and I was probably wearing knee-high boots, dark denim jeans, some type of plaid button-down, I don't know, looking like a cowboy. And she looks up at me and she's like, oh. And you could just see her whole face, like she couldn't, there was some dissonance there from what she saw and what she thought I was. And we go walk back to the office. I'm like, are you okay with me? Do you want to see one of the other therapists? And she's like, oh, no. You'll be perfect. I can already tell. And after a while later, she told me that she actually felt more comfortable with me than if I would have appeared to her what she thought I was going to be. If I would have been someone in my 40s, a white woman in my 40s, dressed all professionally, she said it's a lot easier. So that kind of dissonance, using our bodies, ourselves, that authenticness, the relational component, because you keep bringing that up, relational, and I'm totally on board with that. Everything's relational. It, despite looking kind of odd, like I do, you know, people either they get used to it or they tend to feel a little more comfortable. Maybe not always in the beginning, but once they start talking to me and they see that training or intelligence or whatever it is that gets that buy-in, like I think just our look brings down that barrier of kind of that us versus them. Like I'm just another person. I just happen to communicate a little bit better than some.
No, definitely, for sure. Like you're speaking again, speaking to my heart. I am a black man from Baltimore, Maryland, in a profession industry that is dominated by middle-aged white women. I realized that going in. So nobody expects to see me, especially when, now that I have my doctorate degree, like it's like people fall out of their chairs. Like, what do you do? What you? And you're exactly right. Like, you don't look odd. You look like a person. And the problem with this profession, I believe, is that we believe that you look odd and I look odd. You and I are the anomalies. But the people who fit the status quo are the ones who are telling you what a social worker should look like. And, I'll give you my experience going through my doctorate. So I had no business going for my doctorate degree. It is a program that is designed for people who have been in the profession for, 10, 15, 20 years, already licensed, and they want to move on to the next level. I finished my master's degree in 2017, about 10 days after I left the Marine Corps. So I was a Marine for 15 years, and along the way decided that this is what I'd rather do. Finished my master's degree, and then they started calling me, the school, probably because they want more of my money. Said, "Hey, we got this doctorate program kicking off. You should apply." And I'm like, "Okay, I finished my MSW 10 minutes ago. Why me?" And they're like, "Okay, we need you to prove that you have leadership experience." And I'm like, "Okay, cool." And I did up my application, and I was like, "Marines," and they were like, "Accepted." Like, so through, like, that was it. That's what it took. But I get there, and so now I'm in class with, and I love all my classmates. I love my cohort and all of them, but they all, what I learned is they are so set in their ways. They are the gatekeepers of social work. They are the ones who define all of the stuff that we learn in school. And they are so far removed from being real people. So when the instructor, the professor asks a question, they're all answering with professional experience, and I'm answering with ignorance. But my ignorance in this point is a tool, because I'm more like the people that they're trying to fix than them. So, I'll give you an example. One day we were talking about, we kind of like crisis intervention, right? Or addiction. We were talking about addiction. And, they're talking about how to validate that. So you have this kid, this guy who's addicted to heroin, and they're all given these very clinically evidence-based practice approaches, like, I understand why you're addicted to heroin. I understand why you do that. It gives you fulfillment. It makes you feel full. Let's work on getting off of it, though, because you got to find fulfillment in something else. And then enter me, ignorant young guy. And I'm like, "Hey, dude, heroin's fucking stupid. It's going to ruin your life. Stop doing it." And they're looking at me like, "Oh my God, William, that's the most amazing thing we've ever heard." And I'm like, "No shit. Of course, tell them what they need to hear. Stop giving them excuses. Stop relying on education. Like, you don't need a book to teach you how to be a person." Nobody gives a shit about what I think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs when they're addicted to heroin. They want to know that I care enough about them to help them get their life back together. And that whole experience was just like that. So they all think that I'm like some kind of savant, and I'm like, "Dude, I'm a person. I'm a guy, and I want to talk to people how I would want to be talked to if that were me."
I've had those moments. So I start back at school in not next week, I think the following Monday, and I'm in my dissertation for my DSW, and it's just I have no idea. I have no idea what I'm doing. That's been made clear before. And I want to do all these great things, but you're right. Some of the stuff I've heard and I've seen, and I'm connecting with a lot of DSW students, not from my program or my cohort, but from all over the US. And everyone's doing different things as far as like capstone projects, dissertations, whatever they want to call them. And it's really interesting to see this, but at the same time, it's like I finished my master's in 2016. I'm not that far ahead of you. I don't have 15 years of experience in the Marines or that type of leadership. I have a lot of other stuff. I have a varied career in all sorts of things that maybe I shouldn't have been doing with my bachelor's degree, but because of the way the laws and regulations were, I got a lot of experience in crisis and mental health along the way. So I had some background. I've done volunteer work. My bachelor's degree is a whole bunch of nothing, but I learned a lot. So now you're right, I'm in this DSW program and I'm thinking, oh, dude, what the fuck am I doing? I really need to finish this. And how do I do it in a way that's going to get accepted? Because I feel a little like I'm on the outskirts. I want to do all these things that is going to make waves. And I keep getting told by people who are probably a little bit smarter than me and a lot wiser, just get it done. And a huge part of me is like, am I giving up my principles to do that? I mean, like, that's all I have is ethics. I don't believe in anything else except being a good person, being an ethical person. Like, I don't measure that against in religion or anything like that. So if I give up that foundation of belief that, you have these things and I put them aside just to finish this, like, is that it? So it's very frustrating. There are parts of our education, and even as a white person who's has educated parents and is kind of knows how to manipulate the system, it's still just stunning how difficult it is to go against the status quo and to question your own profession and the education behind it. And I know that's moving forward. There are lots of people now questioning it in higher ed, but is it enough? And what do I do in the meantime?
Oh yeah, for sure. So, the first point that I want to highlight, your bachelor's degree of not knowing what you're doing, that's exactly what you should be doing. That like your bachelor's degree, you're trying to figure out what it is that you're going to do. The people who already think that they know they're going to do and follow the rules to get to the point where they get to where they think they're supposed to be, ultimately end up upset because they followed somebody else's dream. You should be taking that time to figure out what it is. And as I'm going through my program, there was one program where it was one class that I took. The whole thing is about innovation. It says, hey, innovate. Come up with a program or a policy that will innovate one of the 12 grand challenges of social work. And I had one class, I mean, this one professor gave me such a hard time because I was like, listen, I want to break HIPAA. I think that HIPAA is in the way, and too many people are afraid to be creative because they're more worried about being sued. In a world where people you talk to are comfortable with sharing their entire lives on social media, they'll tell you where they are, they'll take a picture of their meal, take a selfie, they'll tag them. Nobody cares about privacy the way that we used to when HIPAA came around. And every time that I brought this up, I'm like, okay, I'm going to be innovative. And the instructor was like, okay, William, I'm going to stop you right there. You can't do that. You can't do that. And I'm like, well, why not? Like, because you can't. That's not the way that we do. You're going to get in trouble. And I'm like, dude, if it's innovation, if it doesn't make you uncomfortable, it's probably not different enough. And I thought that I was here to do that. And here you are telling me, yeah, innovate, but innovate within this box. And I'm like, I can't do that. Like, I don't prescribe to that. The advice that you got, just finish. It is the best advice that you can get. And take it from me, kind of, when I finished my degree, it was almost like a bit of, I don't want to call it shame, but it felt like shame because I went through this whole process of education and to get the doctorate degree. And the degrees actually get easier as you go. Like the associate's degree was the hardest degree I ever learned, ever got in my life because I had to still do like algebra and shit, like stuff that I don't care about. Bachelor's degree, you got to throw a little bit of psychology and sociology in there, so it was kind of fun. master's degree was exactly what I wanted. And a doctorate degree, basically, you prove that what you think is legit. Essentially what it is. But you're talking about what you want to talk about. So much easier than algebra. But I thought that there was going to be this moment where, like, okay, you're a doctor now. You're anointed with all this knowledge. You're an expert. You are the mountaintop. You're the guy. You're the man. And that moment didn't come. And I realized that, okay, now I'm a doctor, I'm gonna get to work. And the stuff that I do is exactly the stuff that I was talking about and doing before I ever took any classes. So the epiphany of shame was like, I just went through all of this just to prove that I was good at being myself. And I put the weight on the university to validate me and say, okay, yes, William, you are good at what you do. And anybody that I talk to today, you know, I can go to them and say, hey, I'm Will from Baltimore, listen to my advice. Or I could say, hey, I'm Dr. Coombs, listen to my advice. And they still have the same choice that they always had. They're going to listen to me or they're not. So it's almost like it's this dilemma where I would love to go tell my children, be like me, follow me, get this doctorate degree, become important like me. But I feel like that would be a hypocritical advice, because the real advice should be the things that you're good at doing, do that. And if you're good enough at it, people will find you and you'll find your way, you'll find your lane, you'll find your audience, somebody will pay you to do it. So, I mean, long answer to a short question, but just finish. Because once you finish, then you have to define what that doctorate means to you. For me, it means that if I never would have pursued it, I would have always wondered, but what if I was a doctor? Could I be better at this? And now that I got there, it took me back to reassure the first stuff that I started talking about.
And that's kind of where that original advice
Podcast.
led to was finish the degree, and then once you had it, you can start to specialize and work on the things that are really interested in. I feel like I got a lot from my coursework in my DSW. It elaborated on a lot of stuff that, you get kind of that foundation in your master's. And
Right.
then this just added to it. And it did specialize a couple of things for me. Like it added more populations. So it was fantastic, but at the same time, it's just overwhelming. And I feel like the more I learn, the less I know. I just feel like I'm full of bullshit. Like this is just, oh, I don't know anything. Okay, cool. So the degree's going well, right? Like I totally don't know shit anymore. Okay, I feel very, very empowered with my education right now. But I appreciate you echoing the same thought process of just do it, get the doctorate, prove that you can do it, because that's part of it for me. I have to prove that I can do it because I should have been dead 3 years ago. But I'm not, so I better do everything, right? That's healthy.
For
I
sure.
think
It,
that's
no,
totally
definitely.
healthy.
Definitely. No, you're so, and it's like it's polish on what you're already doing. I think the thing that we ignore is that we think that what we're doing right now is going to change once we reach another level. But the thing that we're doing right now, like your podcast and the whole Roving Social Worker brand, that's what you do. When you finish the degree, it puts a little polish on it. So now you're the doctor roving social worker, but you're already good at what you do. You already know the things that make up why you exist, why you're here, why you're good at. And if you don't highlight those qualities, you're really compromising a lot of the value that you are. And that's the kind of thing that I tried to get to other people to understand when I was, you know, working for the county and I was in that structure, is that, you know, all of these cliche cookie cutter practices are great, but if I go in here and I say the same thing that the last therapist said, then really what difference does it make? Well, how about next time I just show up and just give them the book? Like, here's the book of things to say. Read that and, you know, have a nice day. it completely takes me out of the equation. The value that I have as a person is now suppressed because I just said the same carbon copy crap that the last therapist just said. So that's why I would meet people and I'd be like, if I piss them off, I piss them off. But you know what? They'll remember me because out of the eight social workers that they saw, the first seven gave you the same thing. And this last dude, here's this black dude that doesn't belong here. You know, he's not a mental health white girl. He's totally different. And he's cussing at me. And he told me, stop doing drugs or I'm gonna kill myself. That's what I want. And doesn't have to be the moment that saves their life, but maybe it plants a seed. And maybe next time, before they go down that path, they hear me because it's different, because it's something they haven't heard yet. And you know, I honestly think that we're cheating ourselves if we don't believe in who we are. You know, you don't go to school to become a different person. You don't go through a doctorate degree to become a different person. There are already enough people doing that. And you know, it's funny, everybody wants to tell you that Microsoft and Windows and IBM is the way to go until Steve Jobs shows up and kicks everybody's ass. Now we can't live without the iPhone, right? Everybody wants every, and they think that that guy is exceptional. They think that that guy is some kind of special person, when in reality, that's somebody who is willing to do their own thing and make their own path. And once it catches on and everybody else catches up, then we understand the value of what that means.
What got you to social work? Like, was it an epiphany? Was it a moment with a social worker? Was it like, why social work? There's a thousand different things you could have done.
So it was a long epiphany. I think even when I was still in the Marines, I was always that guy who people were comfortable talking to. You know, people would come, you know, I worked in intelligence. So my office was basically a confidential space. Like you couldn't get in and out of my office without, you know, being able to have access to that space. So people knew that when they came in there, that their secrets were safe with me. But even more than that is, you know, people have always approached me and told me how they feel. And I get joy in listening to people's stories and giving them a different perspective. I was having a conversation. I guess my light bulb moment was just before we were living in Virginia and we had orders to come out to California. And I was talking to my father. We were on the East Coast, so I was able to see my parents pretty regularly. And he came to see me in the backyard, and he was saying, you know, this is it. Like, you guys are leaving. My grandkids are leaving, and I'm not going to see you guys. And I said to him, you know, why don't you come out with us? You know, at the time, he wasn't working, and he was staying at my grandmother's house, so he really didn't have anything to lose. And he was very hesitant. My dad's very stubborn. He's like, I'm not feeling that. I'm not going to do that. And then I can't explain the feeling that I got, but I got like this, almost like the butterflies that you get when you're on a roller coaster. And like that tingle came over me. And I got that. And I started giving him advice. And as I was talking, I didn't know what I was going to say, but the words were coming out from somewhere. And that was, you know, long story short, I convinced him to come out to California, and his life has flourished ever since. But that was the first time that I noticed that, like, I really enjoy doing this. And how do I find a job that allows me to do the thing that I enjoy doing? You know, so I started a bachelor's in psychology and got that. And then as you know, finish my bachelor's degree, and I'm like, okay, I can go one of two ways. I can go psychology, which is the cliche way. But you have to go to the doctorate level before you can start practicing. And as somebody asked me about the MSW, why don't you think about being a social worker? And of course, at the time, I'm like, okay, I don't want to take anybody's kids away. I don't want to work for Child Protective Services. I don't want to do that, you know, from my ignorant mind. But then realizing that the degree is really, it touches anybody or any profession that has human beings. It's somebody who understands people. And you can take that degree and do whatever you want to do with it. And once I realized the reach that the degree would have, I was hooked. And I finally started taking classes in social work, and I'm like, yo, this is it. This is what I'm like, learning about the brain is cool and everything, but I'm really more interested in what it's like growing up in the hood and what effect that has on people and what poverty does, and the whole biopsychosocial is what got me, because I think that's more important and that's what relates more to people. So, ever since then, social work was it for me, because I understand it for what it is, not the closed-minded way that most of us view it.
That's excellent. Is there, before we wrap up, is there anything else you would like to say, add words of wisdom?
I guess the best words of wisdom or advice that I can give to anyone listening, professional or otherwise, is don't compromise the value of who you are. So many people throw that away for what they think they're supposed to do, or the path that they think they're supposed to follow, or they're waiting for somebody to tell them what to do. The best thing that you could ever do is already inside of you. And you probably spent a lot of time neglecting that because, you're trying to appease a demographic or to get a degree or whatever the reason. Please don't compromise the value of yourself. That's kind of what, my platform, Talk Taylor, is designed for, is to provide something for people to help discover themselves. In the realest way possible, not in a Tony Robbins way or a motivational speaker way, but let's sit down and talk about who you are. And most of the time, that answer is right in front of you. People just aren't willing to acknowledge it because they think that, they think there's something else, or they're waiting for somebody to validate them. And you don't need that. You just got to be confident in becoming who you are and let that flourish, even if it's orange-haired traveling social worker. Like, do it to the fullest. Have the orangest hair and travel the farthest distance, the furthest distance. Do it as a doctor.
Thank you. That is fantastic advice. I appreciate you taking time to talk to me and to do this. I'm not sure if this was like an interview or an intervention for me. Either way, I hope it's informative to other people who will be listening to it. And that's it. If you need more roving social worker, you can find me on my Instagram and Twitter as travel underscore MSW. Until next time, friends and travelers, this ends today's segment of the Roving Social Worker Podcast. Travel well and keep on traveling. All right, we're good. Thank you. I
All right.
appreciate it.
No problem.
Yeah,
You're welcome.
I will definitely have my partner listen to this soon after I edit it up a little bit. Most of the stuff, though, I'm not going to release until I'm done recording. And I have people requesting to talk to me through like December. So I'm looking at starting releasing this like in January, unless people start talking to me quicker.
Okay. Well, you're already on your way then. Just let me know. Like, let me know when
I
it's out
will.
there, so I can I want
Oh,
to spread it
I'll
out. And
tag you.
yeah.
Oh, I will tag you. No
Perfect.
doubt. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.